only of Geronimo, but of the L.A. 13. Meanwhile, in between this arrest and the L.A. shootout, all the little lackeys had done everything they possibly could to dissipate the support of the people. And this is how they operate. They operate this everywhere. And this is why this whole so-called movement is in this present state, because they've terrorized, arrested, convicted, and done all these things to demoralize and have people isolated and confused. And this is just a tactic. It's a tactic called for by the Nixon administration, just as the assassination of Bunchy Carter and John Huggins on this campus was a tactic implemented by this Nixon administration. And this so-called Nixon administration is the same one that's having all these people look, oh, Nixon's going to China. Now, what do you think he's going to China for? To help you? Because he wants to end the war in Vietnam? You don't have to go all there to do it. Whatever he's going over there for, you can believe it, it's against your interests. What you have to realize, because you're in it too, all of you are in it, whether you like it or not, that there is a vice being created by a new alignment of great powers throughout the world. And you think you know who the great powers are.
Listen to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. Listen to Kathleen Cleaver, the Black Panther Party, speaking at UCLA in 1971. So please stay tuned.
And the U.S. imperialists and their henchmen in Africa, in Asia, and Latin America are rearranging the manner in which they relate to each other, the manner in which they move, so that they will be able to better deal with the situation on the defensive. Because you have to realize that these pigs, these imperialist aggressors, these vicious, murderous, barbarous beast that cause murder, torture, and suffering to the peoples of the world in Asia, in Africa, in Latin America, everywhere, and here, this is the headquarters. These people are making a strategic retreat. And they're withdrawing from Asia. And they've made certain arrangements to deal with Latin America. And they have a certain concentration that they're moving on next. And whether you know it or not, you need to, brothers and sisters, you need to. It's Africa. And you have to look at the situation and see where it's at. They want to maintain Israel as a state of their, how would you say, their colony in the northern half. And southern Africa in the southern part. And the South African racist governments, fascist governments of South Africa, southern Rhodesia, and southwest Africa are making a coordination among themselves so that they will be able to deal economically and politically with the revolutionary forces, with the guerrilla forces that are moving in their territory. I don't know if you've heard about the bombings within southern Africa. I don't know if you've heard about the guerrilla attacks in South Africa, and prime ministers say, well, we're not going to run across the border after these guerrillas. We're not going to do that. You know, but they're going to make arrangements with southern Rhodesia so that they get them, you see? And there are liberation forces fighting on the ground in Africa and have been fighting an armed struggle for quite some time. And it should be clear, it is very clear, that it's these forces that are left out of these negotiations and these deals and these great power discussions, you see? It's these forces right here that have to take what they can get, and it's us over here that ain't nobody consulting us about nothing. Nothing, you see? Not even the LAPD and what they're running down on this courthouse, what they're running down throughout this city, and you need to investigate that. You call yourselves students, well, study that. Study reality. Study what's outside of there, you see? Study something that'll help people be able to deal with this situation instead of some trip. Because you can trip on into a concentration camp, baby. We have to recognize that the time is now to intensify our efforts politically, militarily, socially. And at the present time, you see people retreating and, what do you call it, de-emphasizing. They're going in the opposite direction. You're going in the direction that these pigs want you to go in. You're giving them a break. while they get this other stuff in order, while Nixon goes to China and Agnew goes to Greece and Hirohito goes to Brussels and Houphouet Boigny calls for less dialogue with South Africa and the Portuguese mercenaries and the CIA mercenaries and Angola plot on how to destroy the government of the People's Republic of the Congo, the only Marxist-Leninist state in Black Africa, a population 1 million, with the People's Army, with a political revolutionary Marxist-Leninist party in power, in control of the government, with the president of the country and the president of the Central Committee of their party, one and the same person. With Mobutu. Now, if you know anything about Black Africa and the political developments there, you know who Mobutu is. And you know who Lumumba is. And you know Mobutu was among that clique that murdered Lumumba. And I think you know how the Afro-American people feel about Patrice Lumumba. And I think you ought to know how the African people feel about Patrice Lumumba. And I think you need to know that there is a direct relationship between our struggles that's on the ground, that's against these forces of repression and aggression and murder that are racist, fascist, imperialist beasts. Now that might sound striking to you, but this is exactly what they are and exactly what they're doing in Vietnam, what they're doing in Korea, what they've done in the Congo, and what they're doing in Los Angeles. And you have to recognize that as a reality. Whether you recognize it or not, that's an objective condition. Whether you call them beasts now or you wait 20 years later and say, oh, children, they were some real beasts. I'm sorry I didn't deal with it then. You know, I mean, ain't nobody waiting on you. I'm just telling you, you see, that there is a very crucial time right now when a lot of realignments and reshiftings are being made. And people that are concerned about the revolutionary struggle in this country recognize that and are moving to do what they can to strengthen this shit, because we see, as a result of all the activities of the past 10 years, the riots and rebellions, the acts of people's warfare throughout the past 10 years, that our base is very strong. There's no need for this intimidation and this paranoia. Do you know why they run all this Pan-African madness through these campuses? So you sit up and trip on Pan-Africanism and won't think about what's going on in Cairo, Illinois. And do you know what's going on in Cairo, Illinois? What? For 2 years, the people in that community have been engaged in armed confrontation every night with the racist forces of the police department, the Ku Klux Klan, the American Nazi Party, the state troopers, fighting with tanks and machine guns directed towards the Black community. You have a division there, 3,000 Black people against 3,000 white people, and they're fighting. And they have been fighting for 2 years, and they ain't nobody giving up no details on how many's dead and wounded on either side, but it's not very many. And you have to recognize the situation in Wilmington, North Carolina, where the fascists have just said, well, we're ready for the Civil War. We accept your challenge, you know. Let's deal with it. Let's get it on. And you have to realize that the fascists are preparing this type of thing. Under your noses, they don't give you any information on what you're doing. You turn up one morning and look around and say, oh, you think you're going to the elections. You might be going off into a concentration camp. These communities inside the United States represent the model of the future. And we have to recognize in our cities, in our ghettos, in our things, that we will be encircled, we will be surrounded. We have to develop tactics and practices that will enable us to survive this stage of the warfare. We have to be in a position to prepare ourselves now to endure the conditions of war that will be visited upon us. The reason I keep bringing up to you the conditions of the LA 13 and Brother Geronimo is because of the way it reveals the profound conspiracy over months and months and months hatched by all the agencies of the Los Angeles Police Department and the FBI in coordination with the headquarters in Washington and the Pentagon, etc., to destroy a handful of Black Afro-American revolutionaries or fighters or lumpen proletariats beginning to develop an ideology in the heart of Los Angeles. They went through all through these changes to do that. You have to recognize what kind of power that represents and why they have to deal with all these changes just to deal with this small group and what it is that threatens them and how do they work and how do they operate and investigate that. You see? And get those details and bring them out and go and take them out into the black community where people care about this stuff. You understand me? Or do you care?
Listen to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. Listening to a speech by Kathleen Cleaver of the Black Panther Party speaking at UCLA 1971. So please stay tuned.
Because the efforts on the part of these police with those to destroy the burgeoning leadership, the burgeoning direction, the burgeoning cadre of the liberation forces. These people have destroyed liberation forces, have destroyed struggles, have destroyed undergrounds, parties, revolutions around the world over the past 25 years. You take Indonesia, you can take Turkey, you can take anywhere and see the struggles that they have destroyed. And when you talk about Vietnam and Korea and these places, you talk about the struggles that have transcended all of their efforts to destroy them. So we can't believe that just because a revolution is on the ground, it's automatically going to be successful. That is not the case. And you're dealing with the masters of destruction. You have to face up to the fact that this is the inevitable culmination of all the attacks, the repressions and the aggressive acts being perpetrated in the black community by the organized armed forces of repression, either the police, the courts, or whatever, have one culmination. That culmination is war. And that is what we are confronting. In terms of the confrontation represented by these brothers that are in the Old County Jail presently and receiving no support, no money, court-appointed attorneys, the whole thing is very lackadaisical and the pigs think they have it all sewed up. I have to realize that this is a position, it's a matter of principle, it's a reality, it's a situation, and when those people who stood up for the validity of the principle of not only the right of Afro-American people, black people, oppressed people to wage armed struggle and self-defense, but who actually engaged in this, on this defense of this Gestapo raid in the black community on the Central Avenue headquarters of the Black Panther Party. They expose a very basic contradiction that's apparent not only in the operation they call the Black Panther Party, but throughout this so-called movement, throughout this country, on the principle of whether armed struggle is or is not possible, valid, and whatever. And there are a lot of people that go around talking this talk. But when it comes down to it, they turn around and let you deal with it. Nine of you go to deal with it, and one of you end up with all the pigs, you see? And that's the situation that's been our fate for so long, that we got to recognize that and stop repeating ourselves and raise the things to a higher level, because that's where they're going, around the country and around the world. The opposition, the enemy, the power structure is raising theirs to a higher level to be better prepared to deal with what they have foreseen in the period of the 60s and early 70s. I would ask you, and I know there may be maybe one or two, so I'm just asking you, if you will, if you are concerned, students, especially black students, to take it upon yourselves to go down to the Old County Courthouse, Old County Jail, and investigate that. Take it upon yourselves to listen to what's being said about the LAPD and investigate that. And take it upon yourselves to relate to the needs and the practical, present, program that we can apply to forward the Afro-American liberation struggle. The one thing that we're interested in carrying out at this present time is the development of what we call the Revolutionary People's Communication Network, which is an apparatus which will link up the information facilities that are available to us so that information such as this, so that the case of the LA 13 does not go down the drain for lack of information, so that the situation of the contradictions within the party, so the situation with the split within the League of Black Workers and the International, I'm sorry, the League of Black Workers and the International Black Workers Congress does not go ignored. So the situation within the Republic of New Africa and their split does not go ignored, because a split is just a process of transformation and growth within a political apparatus, and the whole thing 20 years later will culminate in some apparatus that all of this is the groundwork for. You have to recognize that struggles develop in phases, on levels, and that you people here who are capable of doing certain things, you shouldn't be so slack. You see what I'm saying? That there is a lot that can be done that does not call that much from you, if it's nothing more than passing out a leaflet or helping put out a newspaper or getting on the radio or going down to a courtroom. But if you show some concern, you see, because what we're talking about and what we've always talked about is the power of the people, you see? The people have this power to defeat this. It has been demonstrated in Cairo, the power of the people united around their own desire to survive and defeat this attack, that they can survive. It has been demonstrated over 25 years in Vietnam, the tremendous, irresistible power of the people once properly organized, properly directed, educated, and continually elevated to a higher and higher level of struggle. And we have to recognize these dialectics and recognize these phases and identify these things and find out how we ourselves can apply these principles to the situation of the Afro-American people. And this is what the contradiction of the Black Panther Party came about in the first place, basically how we apply the principles, the principle of armed struggle, the principle of educating the masses, the principle of organizing the people, the principle of many other things. If you really want to know, you can check out the Red Book. They all outline there. And just because Nixon's going over there doesn't change it. It's still valid. You see what I'm saying? So basically, we're coming from the same point that all the members of the LA 13, the victims of this police conspiracy on a city, state, and national and international level, right here in your backyard, downtown LA, are victims of. And we're coming from the same principle that they came from that has proven to be successful, and that is dare to struggle, dare to win. All power to the people, brothers and sisters.
Hi, I'm Sabelle. I am on CFRU 93.3 FM, and you can be too.
Living on Less is a free 8-week workshop series focused on helping people to be more gentle on their wallets and on the environment. Each week, various expert speakers will present on a variety of topics, such as DIY eco-cleaning products, budgeting, homemade gift-giving, ways to save energy around the home, and more. Each workshop features a hands-on element and is great for anyone who's struggling on a budget or is interested in being more eco-friendly in their everyday lives. Workshops run every Monday morning, 10 a.m. to noon, from January 18th to March 7th, excepting February 15th, with snacks served beforehand at 9:30. They'll be taking place at St. James the Apostle Church, 86 Glasgow Street North, a physically accessible location. Childcare is available on site, but participants must register for childcare in advance. To register, email livingonless@sjapostle.ca or call 226-316-2413. Check out facebook.com/livingonlessguelph for a full list of workshops.
Tune into Viejoteca every Tuesday from 6 to 8 p.m. on CFRU 93.3 on the FM dial, or listen online at www.cfru.ca, Canada's number one salsa radio show. Vaya.
A todos en general, yo les quiero. my boyfriend can't stop drinking until he drinks too much. A friend suggested Al-Anon family groups. She said there are no dues or fees. At first, I was afraid to go to Al-Anon. I felt like a fool to care about somebody who can't stop drinking. But Al-Anon members know exactly how I feel. Is someone's drinking troubling you? You might be surprised at what you can learn in an Al-Anon family group from people just like you. Call 1-888-4-ALANON or go to alanon.org.
To explain to you also your soul, your needs, your political desires and needs, because that is Huey's soul. When we first organized the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense, Huey said, Bobby, he says, we're going to draw up a basic platform, just basic, that black people can read. He says, we don't want to go real elaborate with all these essays and dissertations and all this stuff, because the brother gonna look at that and he said, man, I ain't got time for that. I gotta go see what I can do for myself. He said, just a basic platform that the mothers who struggle hard to raise us, that the fathers who worked hard, that the young brothers in school who come out of school semi-illiterate. He would say, we want freedom, we want power to determine the destiny of our black community, full employment for our people. Number three, we want housing fit, decent housing fit for shelter of human beings. Number four, we want all black men to be exempt from military service. Number five, we want decent education for our black people in our community that teaches us the true nature of this decadent racist society, and to teach black people and our young black brothers and sisters their place in society, because if they don't know their place in society and in the world, they can't relate to anything else. Number six, we want an end to the robbery by the white racist businessmen of black people and black people in their community. Number seven, we want an immediate end to police brutality and murder of black people. Number eight, we want all black men held in county, state, federal jails and prisons to be released because they have not had a fair trial, because they've been tried by all white juries, and that's just like being tried in Germany being a Jew. We want black people, number nine, when brought to trial, to be tried by members of their peers. And a peer being one who comes from the same economic, social, religious, historical, and racial background. If the United States government and the courts and the local courts did this, they would have to choose black people from the black community to sit up on the jury. They'd have to choose some of the mothers who've been working 20 years in Miss Ann's kitchen scrubbing floors like my mother had done. They have to choose some of them hardworking fathers. They have to choose some of those brothers who stand on the block out there wondering where they're going to get a gig. They're going to have to choose these black people. And number 10, he would say, let's just summarize it. We want housing, we want clothing, we want education, we want justice, and we want peace. This is a basic platform. In case you never knew it or not, of all the things that you've heard in the press, of all the derogatory statements that's been made in the press about Brother Huey P. Newton and I, of all these derogatory statements to guide you away from seeing this basic platform that Huey was talking about for his own people. We have to learn to look through the white press. We have to learn to see what's going on. Now, out of this platform, Huey P. Newton realized that it was necessary for us to start working on these points, these 10 points, practically. Remember number seven? We want an immediate end to police brutality and murder of black people. This is very, very important. And here, whether you know it or not, is where you start dealing with the black revolution. When Huey says, every black man, put a shotgun in your home,
And once we let the man know, say, look, we armed from block to block, and we're going to patrol you from our windows. And we're not going to have you brutalizing none of our people in the streets. Do you realize what kind of power black people have then? Because you begin to neutralize that police force, because them cops going to start riding shaky and scared. In fact, we're in a position then to demand that they withdraw from our community because they occupy our community just like a foreign troop occupies territory. Very important to understand. We hate cops beating black people over their heads and murdering them. That's what we hate. Enough energy to sit down and hate a white person just because of the color of his skin, you waste a lot of energy. You better take that same energy and put it in some motion out there and start dealing with those oppressive conditions, and you're gonna find out just what you hate and what you're gonna stop. Black people, we are organizing to stop racism. You dig it? When you stop racism, you stop brutality and murder of black people by the racist occupying army in our black community. That's what we're going to stop. What's being done to us? You dig it? Can you dig the white power structure and this racist police force and how they've escalated the situation? That before Watts, there was 1,300 cops. Now there's 6,000 cops patrolling black people. That in Oakland, they had 350 cops just 3.5 years ago. Now they got 1,000 cops patrolling black people. San Francisco's double its police force. And every area, major metropolis where black people live all across this country, they've doubled, tripled, and quadrupled their police force, equipped them with tanks, all kinds. We got to stop it, brother. Let's get together and unify.
Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU, I'm Siegfried, and I never get tired of playing that clip from Bobby Seale talking about the Black Panther Party's 10-point program. I know I've played it on this show again and again, many, many times. Many times is the intro for the show, and just it's never inappropriate to play the 10-point platform of the Black Panther Party. Like, it's still absolutely relevant to this day. Of course, I've talked many, many times about what happened, of course, in Ferguson last year, and of course, the ongoing protests, Black Lives Matter, and the ongoing struggles of African Americans against the racist, you know, settler state, capitalist state in America, and how that goes on. You know, it's just as relevant as it was in the 1960s, that speech. So, it being the last day, and certainly went by way too fast, the last day of Black History Month, I decided I would be talking about the Black Panther Party and the kind of impact that it had on the African-American struggle for liberation, like in the United States, and the impact it had like on not only on the African-Americans, but also on, you know, other oppressed communities in the United States, and even on like poor working class white people, as I was quite surprised to find out myself, and also the impact it had internationally. You know, The Black Panthers certainly punched far above their weight, you know, and their influence is still felt to this day. So I thought I would bring somebody who is very knowledgeable on this particular subject in the studio to talk with me today. So I brought in a comrade from the Young Communist League. I brought in Brendan Campisi, who has been on the show before. It's been a while, I believe, Brendan. You were talking to Patrick last year while I was in China. About Gabriel Kolkol, and the last time I think you remember, you were talking about the Korean War and the lead up to the Korean War and the Korean people's struggle for liberation against Japan and then ultimately against America.
So, yeah, that sounds about right. It's good to be back here. It's always good to be here on Back in the USSR.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's good to have you back. So just to kind of give, maybe you could kind of just originally put it in context, how did the Black Panther Party emerge in the first place? Because, of course, we hear a lot, about, especially with movies like Selma recently coming out, and, you know, you hear a lot about, of course, Martin Luther King and the kind of the original protest in the civil rights movement and this sort of thing. We basically are told, but we're only told that, like, definitely one side of the story.
Yeah.
You know, we're not told about the emergence of the Black Panther Party and the kind of context that it emerged from. So maybe you could kind of elaborate on that.
That's a very good point. Hollywood doesn't really make movies about the Black Panther Party. The Black Panthers are in Forrest Gump, if I recall. And it's been a long time since I've seen that, but they're definitely not portrayed in any kind of positive way in what is a profoundly conservative film. But Yeah, it's a good question, talking about where the Black Panther Party comes from. So the context for the emergence of the Black Panther Party is marked by a couple of things. As you said, this is the moment of the civil rights movement, or the moment after, in some ways, the civil rights movement. I'm going to challenge a bit of the framing of that in a second. But it's also the moment of decolonization.
Mm-hmm.
It's the moment of third world liberation struggles. It's the moment of the struggle of the people of Vietnam against the U.S. intervention and the puppet state in South Vietnam. Those are the two sort of fundamental conditions for the emergence of the Black Panther Party. And the Black Panther Party itself is founded in Oakland in 1966 by two community college students, Huey Newton and Bobby Seale. But there's a bit of, and it, then it spends the next couple of years of its life mostly as a small local group in Oakland. Later, there's a chapter in Los Angeles. And it's not until the spring of 1968, after the assassination of Martin Luther King, that it expands across the country. But before I talk about that, I'm going to talk a little bit about the ideological and political prehistory of the Black Panther Party. And to do that, I'm mostly going to talk about Malcolm X and the impact that Malcolm X had.
Right.
So, as you mentioned, the civil rights movement, as it's commonly conceived, takes place in the late 1950s and early 1960s. And there is this incredible mobilization of the African-American people, mostly in the South, but also outside, and of white allies, for basically for legal equality and the end of legal segregation in the United States. And that's led by Martin Luther King and by mostly Christian reformist political forces. And then in 1964-65, the Civil Rights Act is signed, the Voting Rights Act is signed, legal segregation in the South begins to be dismantled. It actually takes a bit longer. It's not as if it just disappears in 1965.
Oh, yeah.
But legal segregation, formal segregation, begins to be dismantled. So the terrain of the struggle shifts a bit. It's worth noting that people participating in this movement didn't really call it the Civil Rights Movement very much, especially not at the grassroots. What they called it was the Freedom Movement. And the grassroots people, the farmers and workers in the South, black farmers and workers in the South who were the backbone of the movement, didn't think of it as a movement just for the end of legal segregation. They called it the Freedom Movement, and freedom meant many of the kinds of things that Bobby Seale talks about in that clip. It means many things that were mentioned in the Black Panther Party program. It includes these economic demands. So the movement itself is kind of misunderstood. But in any case, a particular phase of that struggle does end in 1965. And then another set of issues comes to the fore, issues that are not so much the issues specifically of black people in the South who've been living under formal segregation, but the issues of the millions of African Americans living in these large urban concentrations outside the South that have been created over the past few decades, the previous few decades, by the mass migration out of the South in places like Los Angeles and Oakland on the West Coast, and in places like Detroit and Chicago and Gary and Newark and Harlem and Boston in the Northeast and the Great Lakes, basically. And that's the environment that the Black Panther Party will emerge out of. And so there's a new set of concerns. Police brutality is one of them. Unemployment is one of them. Those are probably the two most explosive issues. And from 1964 onward, there's this series of urban rebellions that start. The first prominent one is in Watts in Los Angeles in 1965 or 64. And this continues into the early 1970s. And so there's this very, very clear sign that there's this rage building that's been building up for a long, long time in these urban concentrations outside of the South, especially among young people. And at this point, you also have a new political and ideological leader who comes into the sort of mass awareness of black America and of eventually white America, too. As somebody who can articulate the grievances behind this wave of urban uprisings, and to start to try and articulate a political approach that will appeal to this particular segment of the African American population and the whole community, and that is Malcolm X, who is a minister in the Nation of Islam, which has for a long time up to this point been a very conservative and essentially apolitical organization for a long, long time, there was a formal rule against members of a Nation of Islam being involved in politics. And their solution to the problems of racism and oppression in Black America was essentially a moral redemptive program whereby Black people would overcome the psychological and cultural and moral symptoms of living in a racist society on their own without basically changing the political circumstances, which is essentially in the hand of God. So that's the program of the Nation of Islam up to a certain point. But then Malcolm X starts to develop a more political version of this program. And Malcolm X begins to express a series of ideas that would ultimately be taken up after his assassination in 1965 by the Black Panther Party and by a younger generation of African-American militants. So I'm going to talk a little bit about what those ideas were because I think they're really important to understanding the Black Panther Party and its contribution. So the first three of these ideas can be grouped together, and those ideas are or grouped together very immediately, and those ideas are self-determination, self-defense, and self-respect. Malcolm X talked about those things, the Black Panthers talked about those things. You're going to pause and go into what each of those meant in a concrete sense in the situation of the Black Liberation Movement in America at this time. So self-determination basically meant what Seal explains in the 10-point program. We want the power to determine the future of our Black community. And there's this idea emerging that legal equality is not enough for Black Americans to solve the problems that they face, and relying on alliances with white liberals is no longer enough, especially when gains have been made in terms of formal equality, because white liberals are not interested in going any farther than granting Black people formal equality. So the idea emerges that for real lasting solutions to occur, Black people need to hold power where they live. They need to be in control of the places in which they live. And Malcolm X, in his really, really iconic speech, The Message to the Grassroots, talks about land and political power as being fundamental to the liberation of Black people. And within a few years, you'd have a really remarkable revival in the Black movement and the radical movement in America more generally of an idea that had previously been put forward by the Communist Party in the United States, which is that Black people were a nation with a national homeland in the South and that they should exercise self-determination in that territory. The Black Panthers never exactly held that view, but it was one particular articulation of the idea of Black self-determination. The fundamental idea was that Black people need to have power over their own communities and the circumstances in which they existed for any real lasting solutions to be found. And the second is self-defense. And self-defense is probably the single issue that gets the most attention from white scholars and the white popular media. And there's this when looking at the Black Liberation Movement at this time, and there's this very entrenched framework of King and the pacifist Christian civil rights movement and Malcolm X and the Black Panthers who were violent. That's a really, really, really fundamental misrepresentation in a number of ways. In the first place, self-defense, including armed self-defense, was an essential part of the civil rights struggle in the South. It was an essential part of the freedom movement in the South. And in rural society in the southern United States, it's simply a fact that people are armed. And that included Black people as much as it included white people. And that was a necessary thing, because if you study the movement a bit, then you'll start to learn that even these struggles for formal and legal equality were faced with terrorism from the Klan, from other white racist terrorist organizations, and from the police. So people needed to protect themselves. The young, idealistic student activists who did have these pacifist convictions, white and Black, who went down to the South to register people to vote and to do this kind of work, could never have done it if they weren't being protected by the local rural Black people who were always armed and always ready and willing to protect themselves with arms. So, but then on another level, it's always been wrong to say that Malcolm X, or the Black Panther Party, or the militant section of the Black Liberation Movement in general, has ever advocated violence. because they simply never advocated violence. What they always advocated was self-defense. And the basic fact of the matter is that white America and the American state are violent. The United States is a violent society. And the American state, of course, is an extraordinarily violent institution. King called the American state the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today. And he was, of course, right about that. And it's in that situation that a section of the African American movement was willing to politically say that it was necessary for black people to defend themselves when they were being attacked. And if you look at the situation today, with this enormous struggle going on around police brutality, there have actually been that call has actually reemerged in certain quarters to take up armed self-defense. And it's hard to see, it's not hard to see why that would when the police are the ones who are attacking black communities. And it was a very, very similar situation, of course, that the Black Panther Party emerged out of. And they took up that program of self-defense in a very concrete way, as Seal describes, and took up the work of attempting to defend black communities from racist police. So that's self-defense. It's always necessary to clear away the myths around violence and self-defense in the black liberation movement. And the third is self-respect. And this is very, very important. Because one aspect of the experience of racial or national oppression that it can be easy to lose sight of from the position of, you know, outside supporters or people who are sort of studying this in an abstract way, for those of us who don't experience it, is the psychological dimension and the internal dimension that has to do with the self-worth and the self-respect of oppressed people. And Malcolm X very, very forcefully advocated the reclaiming of dignity and self-worth for black Americans. And you can see where he drew on the program of the Nation of Islam there, because they believed very strongly and they attempted to put into practice building up the self-worth and the dignity of black Americans. Malcolm X basically took that and politicized it. And of course, there's this enormous cultural movement in black America at the same time. People began to change their names, rejecting slave names, rejecting Christianity. People took up what they imagined and at the same time sort of created forms of African culture, African dress and African names, especially Swahili mostly. And people took up Islam, both in the unorthodox forms of Nation of Islam and mainstream Sunni Islam, which, of course, Malcolm X turned to at the end of his life. And the Black Panthers, for the most part, were never really into that. Especially the leadership in Oakland, they were very, very secular people, and they called that kind of cultural movement, they referred to it as pork chop nationalism, specifically a reference to Islam, of course. And they didn't see that as being any kind of real solution or having any sort of real importance to the political struggle. But at the same time, if you look at the art of the Black Panther Party, the iconography of the Black Panther Party, and the way the images that the leaders, the leadership of the party, people like Newton and Seal and Cleaver were able to create for themselves, they were attempting at the same time as all this was going on to instill a sense of dignity and self-worth and pride in black Americans, especially in black American men. A lot of this was done in a very particularly gendered way. It was particularly geared toward men. But yeah, that's the third point being self-respect. So those are three of the essential contributions that Malcolm X first articulated in a way, and the Black Panther Party would later take up. And there are two more. One is connected to the idea of self-determination, and that gets into the issue of who are the African-American people in the sense of what is the basic situation of this group of people and their relation to the rest of the society in which they live. And in the time of the Civil Rights Movement, as we've been discussing it, the political forces leading that movement, you know, people like King, had basically a conception of the African American people as a minority within American society who had been excluded from full participation in that society by unjust discrimination. But Malcolm X rejected that view entirely. And he said that black Americans were not effectively Americans at all, that they were a nation, a colonized nation, living within the borders of the United States, essentially kept within American society by force. And he – probably the most sort of popular way he expressed that, he said, we didn't land on Plymouth Rock. Plymouth Rock landed on us. And that gets at a historical truth, which is that people of African descent were never intended to be full members in American society. They were, of course, brought to the United States purely to serve as a slave labor force, and were only ever formally, you know, only formally became citizens after the Civil War, after the United States had existed for decades as a nominally democratic society from which they were completely excluded. So there's a very strong historical basis to the argument that African Americans were never supposed to be included in this society. And the Black Panthers took that up. And they also took a very practical suggestion from Malcolm X and advocated it in their own turn, which is that they should, the African American people should go to the United Nations and demand that the United Nations organize a referendum in which the African American people would be able to make, for the first time ever in their history, a formal political decision, a democratic decision, about their relationship with American society. And there are other organizations, groups like the Republic of New Africa, that took that up at the same time, but we're going to have to leave them out. Although that's a very, very interesting organization, mm-hmm. And the Panthers always had, you know, a much broader movement around them, of course. So, yeah, self-determination, self-respect, and self-defense, and black people as an internal colony. Very, very important contributions from Malcolm X. Mm-hmm. And the last thing that I'm going to talk about in terms of ideological themes that Malcolm X first articulated is what you could call third world internationalism. And just to go back to something that I said when I was describing the basic conditions of the moment that the Black Panthers emerged out of. And I said that it was the moment of decolonization. And what you have is, over a generation starting, I guess, at the end of the Second World War with the independence of India and the revolution in China, is you have this massive earth-shaking change in the political situation of the formerly colonized regions of the earth where the vast majority of humanity up to 1945 had lived in Asia and Africa and the neo-colonial region of Latin America. And there was an enormous amount of optimism at this time in the 1950s and 60s about the future of those societies. There was a sense that all the hope of humanity resided in those parts of the world. And the term third world, which today, to a lot of people, has very negative connotations, was meant to express that optimism. It was originally coined in reference to the third estate, the way it was spoken of during the French Revolution. What is the third estate? Nothing. What does it desire to become? Everything or something. And the third world was coined, the term was coined by analogy to that. And in 1955, there was the beginning of an organized third world presence on the world stage with the Bandung Conference, where the leaders of Indonesia, India, Ghana, Egypt, and Yugoslavia came together to start articulating the position of this section of humanity on the state of the world. And Malcolm X thought that was an enormously positive development. And he came to conceive of the world situation as being characterized by the escalating and increasingly successful struggle of essentially the colonized, dark-skinned majority of humanity, the black and brown majority of humanity, against racist imperialism. And that was his fundamental picture of the world. And he traveled to Africa. He met Nasser. He traveled to the Arab world. I can't remember right now if he ever traveled to East Asia, but he did at least travel throughout the old world, meeting these new nationalist leaders and attempting to get support for the African-American liberation struggle, which he was, you know, successful to an extent in doing. And this ties into the argument about the situation of black people, because not only did Malcolm say black people were not a minority in American society because they were a colonized nation, they were, in fact, as far as he was concerned, not a minority in that they were part of the majority of humanity. not a small group of black people in a continent dominated by white people, but a small group of black people in a world where black people, people of African descent and Asian descent and Native people in the Americas and the Arab people were starting to sweep away white racist imperialism and get rid of it for once, you know, once and for all. So there was an enormous optimism, and there, it was an enormous sort of psychological boon to young African Americans to see themselves as part of this struggle where the Third World was moving forward all the time. And the Panthers contributed. The Panthers, in many ways, developed out of that, but they also contributed to extending it.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, that's what I would say about where the Black Panther Party came from and what, in terms of the political situation that they emerged out of and the ideas that that they tried to take up.
Yeah, so I think I what I'm going to do right now is I'm going to play a clip from Bobby Seale, which kind of like speaks to some of the things that that you just spoke about.
Yeah.
In terms of the context they emerged from. Okay. And some of the history of, like, say, what happened in the early 60s that maybe kind of served as a catalyst in terms of, like, why African Americans believed that they had to change tactics.
Yeah.
Effectively. I want to mention that just last night I actually had a look at a movie which I believe you had the opportunity to go and watch earlier this week, Brendan.
Yes.
And that was the Black Power mixtape. And I guess this isn't like maybe directly like part of what we're talking about, but at the same time, like, it does obviously fit in. When Angela Davis, like, we talked about, like, how, you know, how violence is kind of, you know, this kind of false dichotomy is presented to us.
Yeah.
Between, like, Martin Luther King and Malcolm X and, like, the issue of violence. And basically in the Black Power mixtape, there's an interview of Angela Davis at a time when I believe she was on trial.
Yeah, it's from during the trial.
Yeah, when she was on trial, like, basically a political prisoner, essentially, in the States. You know, the interviewer, who was Swedish, asked her about violence. And she basically said, like, whoever was accusing the African-American, you know, movement for liberation of violence effectively did not know what they were talking about, did not know the context of the American situation, you know, and the kind of violence, of course, the American state was using against them and the need for self-defense. You know, they didn't understand that concept. And, like, really, that still is not understood by so many people today when they look at that, you know, because, of course, like... And one of the last things I want to mention before we kind of get back into things with the Black Panthers is, of course, like, we mentioned just how the main problems that the people who joined the Black Panthers, who were inspired to join the Black Panthers, were facing was unemployment and police brutality. And, of course, we still see that in African-American communities today, you know, the whole movement around Black Lives Matter and all this and the uprising in Ferguson, of course, highlighting these things. And, of course, now on top of that, we have the war on drugs and mass incarceration. You know, I believe Eddie Conway, who was, of course, a member of the Black Panthers in Baltimore, said the situation is even worse today than it was in 1968, so these things are still absolutely relevant to talk about. So, to go forward from this, like, maybe you could start getting into the development of the Black Panthers as an organization.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
So, as I mentioned, for the first year, maybe year and a half of the life of the Black Panther Party, they were essentially a local organization limited to Oakland. And most of the early work they did was around police brutality. Very, very basically, it just started with Newton and Seale engaging in a series of confrontations with police who were in the process of brutalizing and abusing and harassing black people. And they took advantage of a particular California law that allowed the display and sort of open carrying of long guns as long as you weren't actually directly threatening anyone with them. And when that law was going to be changed, basically as a result of their work, a group of Black Panthers went down to the California legislature with guns and attempted to put on a bit of a demonstration and try and block the passage of this law. And that was unsuccessful, but it gave the Black Panther Party, for the first time, the formal name of which at this point was the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense, which shows how fundamental that issue was. Later, the name would be changed. But it gave the Black Panther Party the first national publicity that it received. But the organization still developed fairly slowly after that. Sometime in 1967, a group was established in Los Angeles, but it didn't become a national organization until the spring and summer of 1968. And the main trigger for the national expansion of the Black Panther Party was the assassination of Martin Luther King and the wave of urban rebellions that swept the United States in the aftermath of that. And that was important on a couple of levels. One was that even though young African-American militants had been rejecting the ideas of nonviolence and integration that King had advocated for a long time, they'd been rejecting those things over the past several years before this, mostly under the influence of Malcolm X, the assassination of King was basically the final nail in the coffin of that kind of politics. It was very, very clear that if somebody's going to advocate peace and nonviolence and integration and they're going to kill him anyway, that gave a huge, huge boost to revolutionary politics in the African-American community and in the United States as a whole, which I'll get to. And more immediately, there was a wave of rebellions across the country. 70,000 soldiers and National Guardsmen had to be called out to suppress these riots, as, you know, of course, the state and the white media called them. And dozens of people were killed. There was enormous property damage. Buildings were being burned six blocks away from the White House. There were machine guns on the White House lawn. Because, of course, Washington, D.C. is not just the capital of the United States. It's also a city where the vast majority of people are black and poor. And there was a large rebellion in Washington. So that was very, very symbolic, the fact that they felt that they needed to literally protect the White House and the Capitol building. And then in the aftermath of that, the radicalized and angry and politicized youth of black America turned to a group that is putting forward a message that seems to, and that does speak very, very immediately to their concerns and their needs, and that's the Black Panther Party in Oakland. Newton, in 1967 already, was talking about trying to tap into the anger that was exploding in these rebellions and turn it into something more sustained and more explicitly and coherently political. And in the spring and summer of 1968, that started to happen. And the Panthers didn't even have to recruit. What happened was groups of young activists in cities across the country simply got themselves together and declared themselves, you know, the Kansas City Black Panther Party. And they would call up Oakland, and most of the time they'd get recognition. Sometimes they didn't, and the leadership in Oakland tried to keep things a bit more streamlined. But there was this very, very rapid and somewhat sort of chaotic process of this national organization being formed. And at its peak, it had several thousand members. I've never seen there doesn't seem to be a consensus on the peak members of the membership of the Black Panther Party. You'll see numbers as low as 3,000, sometimes 7,000 or 8,000. In any case, several thousand people, the vast majority of whom were very, very young. Most Panthers were in their 20s or even in their teens. You can see that very clearly in any documentary footage of members of the party. So, yeah, that's the basic contour of a national development of Black Panther Party. And this sort of coincides with a number of other developments that would give them more of an impact and that would enable the Black Panther Party to get more influence. And part of that, a significant part of that, was the continuing escalation of the war in Vietnam and the development of a radical movement among white students, which had its main organizational expression in SDS, in Students for a Democratic Society. And over the course of 1968, SDS starts to move towards the Black Panther Party, and many of these newly radicalized white students, many of whom had gotten into politics in the first place out of support for the civil rights movement in the earlier 60s, especially the older students and older activists among them, began to get more interested in the radical movement. And the Black Panthers helped to radicalize the white movement itself. And this is part of a long-standing dynamic of the African-American movement pulling white leftists and white radicals in America farther than they've previously gone. The Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee condemned the Vietnam War before SDS did. And they were fairly equivalent organizations in terms of their character. They were mostly organizations of students, and in the early 60s, those two organizations had similar politics. But the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee was willing to take that radicalizing political step of condemning the war before SDS was. So the influence of of the Panthers on SDS a few years later was sort of a continuation of that dynamic. And one thing it's important to recognize, and it's really, really striking when you start to look into it, is the scale of the radicalization that happens in the African-American community at this point. One scholar sort of writing about this period, Max Elbaum, in his book Revolution in the Air, which is about the American revolutionary left in the 1970s mostly, but begins with describing the period of the late 60s, says that for a moment at least, revolutionary politics was not a minority position among people of color in the United States under the age of 25. It's very, very possible that in 1968,